I'd like to start with an event of considerable significance that took place last fall, last September. This was the announcement of the national security strategy of the United States, what's been called the Imperial Grand Strategy, which was the framework for the invasion of Iraq and undoubtedly many things to follow. And it was has been high on the global agenda ever since the announcement. The strategy report declared the intention of the most powerful state in history to maintain its dominance over the world through the use of military force. It's the one dimension in which it ranks supreme, competitors in other dimensions. The official formulation is that our forces will be strong enough to dissuade potential adversaries from pursuing a military buildup in hopes of surpassing or equaling the power of the United States. That caused a lot of shudders around the world, including the U.S. foreign policy elite. The next issue, the very next issue of the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, had an article by a well-known international relations specialist, John Eikenberry, discussing the grand strategy. In these words, he said, "The grand strategy begins with a fundamental commitment to maintaining a unipolar world in which the United States has no peer competitor, a condition that is to be permanent so that no state or coalition could ever challenge the United States as global leader, protector, and enforcer. The strategy renders international norms of self-defense enshrined in Article 51 of the UN Charter almost meaningless. In general, it dismisses international law and institutions as being of little value." In fact, if you read the security strategy, you'll find that they're scarcely even mentioned. Going on with Eikenberry, "The new imperial grand strategy presents the United States as a revisionist state seeking to parlay its momentary advantages into a world order in which it runs the show. It will prompt others to find ways to work around, undermine, contain, and retaliate against U.S. power. The strategy may appear to be successful in the short term, given overwhelming U.S. military force, but," he goes on, "it threatens to leave the world more dangerous and divided, and the United States less secure," a view that's incidentally widely shared within the conservative foreign policy elite. The rhetorical radicalism of the imperial grand strategy is highlighted by contrasting it with the conceptions of world order that happen to be reiterated at about the same time by the president of the International Court of Justice, the World Court. This is the very conservative U.S. judge, Judge Schwabel, who's been a lone defender of the United States at the court for many years. He was presenting the ICJ report, annual report, to the General Assembly of the United Nations, and he said, "As the court enters the first century of the third millennium, it stands for international law, not international lawlessness, for the peaceful settlement of international disputes in conformity with international law, not the will of the more powerful party, for international organization, not for international anarchy, or for a state sovereignty which purports to be above the law. It stands for human rights, rights that can be effectively realized only within functioning systems of law, local, national, and international." You couldn't construct a sharper antithesis than this conception from a conservative U.S. justice heading the International Court of Justice and the imperial grand strategy that was announced shortly afterwards. The imperial grand strategy is often described in the press and elsewhere as authorizing preemptive war. That's a mistake and an important one. Preemptive war has a meaning within the framework of international law. Preemptive war is on the border of being permissible under the existing framework of international law. So a preemptive war, for example, would be, planes were flying from across the Atlantic with the clear intention of bombing the United States, and the U.S. Air Force was sent to shoot them down before they bombed and maybe to attack the bases from which they came. That would be the gray area that's called preemptive war. It might fall under Article 51, which grants the right of self-defense against armed attack. That's preemptive war, but that has absolutely nothing to do with what was proposed on last September. That was, it's more accurately called preventive war, meaning you attack someone who you believe may pose a challenge to you in the future. Actually, even the term preventive war is a little misleading, because there doesn't have to be anything prevented. So, for example, the invasion of Iraq didn't prevent anything. It was done for other reasons. It wanted to attack Iraq. Preventive war just means war, and it's been extended already in its first instance of the doctrine to include attacking anybody you feel like. Actually, that's been made pretty explicit. After the failure to discover the weapons of mass destruction that were the pretext, and I mean pretext because I don't think anybody really expected to find them, that were the pretext for the war, after that's failed and sort of disappeared from the news, a high U.S. official of the Bush administration explained that the doctrine of preventive war goes beyond what had been announced. The original announcement was that we're going to prevent the development of weapons of mass destruction by a potential enemy. And since there weren't any, the doctrine has to be expanded. And now the new doctrine, the new expanded version, says that we can carry out a preventive war against anyone who has the ability and intention of developing weapons of mass destruction. Well, ability everyone has. I mean, Arlington High School has the ability to develop weapons of mass destruction. And I suspect if somebody were to do a detailed inspection of the kind they're doing in Iraq and the in the backyard, they'd probably find something left over from the chemistry or biology lab that could indicate that they had the ability to develop weapons of mass destruction. As far as intention is concerned, that's completely in the eye of the beholder. So the doctrine that says we can strike anybody with the ability and intention to develop weapons of mass destruction means very simply we can attack anybody we like on our own authority. And since international laws and institutions are gone, they're simply hot air, as a leading local professor of international law recently put it in Foreign Affairs. That means we just do what we like. We rule the world by force, and nobody can say anything about it. Well, that was last September, one of the events that took place last September. There were two others, also important, though less broad in scale. One event that took place last September, simultaneously with the announcement of the Grand Imperial Strategy, was the beginning of the drumbeat of propaganda about the danger to our existence posed by Iraq. Up until then, it was a sort of nasty place, but starting last September, it became an imminent threat to the survival of the United States. Began with Condoleezza Rice on television, warning that the next thing we'd find out about Iraq would be a mushroom cloud, presumably in New York. Nobody else seemed to expect anything. Shortly after, the Congress was frightened into or railroaded into passing a resolution authorizing the use of force because of the grave threat to the national security of the United States posed by the government of Iraq. And then came a massive onslaught of government media propaganda presenting the message that Iraq was an imminent threat to U.S. security and insinuating that Iraq was responsible for 9/11, was tied up with al-Qaeda and other international terrorists, was planning more. And that had its effects. This is a very frightened country, and it's unfortunately not easy to frighten people. By the end of September and for the subsequent months, a majority of the population came to believe this. Around 60% of the population, varying month to month, did believe that Iraq was an imminent threat to the security of the United States. The United States is alone in the world in that respect. Like the neighboring countries, for example, despised Saddam Hussein, but they didn't fear him. In fact, they'd been trying to reintegrate Iraq back into the region for some years over strong U.S. objections. Now, that includes Kuwait and Iran, both of which were invaded and attacked by Saddam Hussein. So they have little love for him, but they knew he wasn't dangerous. They knew perfectly well exactly what U.S. planners knew, and I presume the editorial offices knew, that Iraq was the weakest country in the region. It had been smashed by the 1991 war. It had a decade of sanctions which devastated the civilian society with horrifying effects. It had been effectively disarmed by the UN inspections. And in fact, its military expenditures were about a third those of Kuwait, which has 10% of its population and far below the major powers in the region. So nobody regarded it as a threat except in the United States, where about 60% of the population regarded it as an imminent threat to us. There's nothing new about that. The congressional resolution, if you read the wording of it, is very similar to a declaration of a national emergency by Ronald Reagan in 1985 when he declared a national emergency in the United States because of the threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua, which, if those of you are old enough to remember, it was Nicaraguans were only 2 days marching time from Harlingen, Texas, and they were waving their copies of Mein Kampf, as Secretary of State Schultz put it, and we're just about on the verge of destruction. Well, that worked too, and it's only one of many. And bear in mind that the people in office now are the same people who were doing it then. This administration is pretty much recycled from the more reactionary elements of the Reagan-Bush 1 administration. So it comes as second nature. It also, over the following months, a substantial part of the population, ultimately about half, came to believe the complete fabrication that, and known to be fabrication, that Iraq was involved in 9/11 and that it had relations with al-Qaeda. There's no intelligence agency in the world who believes that, or a strategic analyst. Nevertheless, it was instituted sufficiently by effective propaganda that when Bush gave his victory speech on the Abraham Lincoln, he was able to declare the victory a victory in the war against terror because of the connections of Iraq to al-Qaeda, which were fabricated by his public relations specialist, as he probably knew. Certainly the press that reported it knew. Well, that had its effect. If you look closely, there was a close correlation between support for the war and belief that Iraq is a threat to our security, was carried out 9/11, was planning to do it again. And that's not really surprising. If you believe those things, There's good reason to go to war, for a preventive war. So the propaganda was indeed spectacularly successful, unique in the United States. If you take away the factor of panic in the United States induced by spectacular propaganda, opposition to the war here was approximately like everywhere, namely overwhelming. This is here. That's what we're worried about. That was the second major event that took place in September. The third major event connected with it was the onset of the congressional midterm election, also in September. And that is connected. It was understood. In fact, Karl Rove, the administration campaign manager, had already informed Republican activists over the summer that that they'd better go into the election on a national security issue. If they went into the election with people worrying about pensions and medical aid and Enron and the rest of the familiar litany, then the administration would get smashed. But if they could shift it to national security issues, they had a chance. People will, especially a frightened population, does tend to huddle under the umbrella of power. It barely worked. They sort of sneaked through the election by a couple of tens of thousands of votes. And if you look at the exit polls, people maintained their preferences for the parties, but they shifted their priorities. So, yes, if you cared about medical care and your pension and so on, they would be opposed to the administration. But if concern about security overwhelmed it, barely. So they managed to sneak by and get another 2 years of power. And Karl Rove has already announced that that's what they're going to have to do for the year for the presidential election. In fact, the Wall Street Journal, one of the more honest journals, report when during this Abraham Lincoln extravaganza a couple of weeks ago, the staged event, pointed out that that's the opening. That's the opening of the presidential campaign. The presidential campaign is going to have to be conducted with the image created image right out of central casting of the war president who saved us from destruction by Iraq and is by then going to be saving us from destruction from some new dragon that will be slain. Republican campaign was delayed, so it opens in mid-September in New York, September 12th. You can write the speeches right now. Okay, but that's the way it's going to have to be done, and they understand it perfectly well. They are carrying out a major assault against the general population. They know it. People know it, and you've got to divert attention away from it. And there aren't a lot of ways to do it. The only way that anyone's ever figured out is fear. For the people in Washington now, it is second nature. That's the way they're following a script which is very close to their first tenure in power, 1981 to 1992. Just take a look at that period, and you see the script laid out very clearly. Through that period, too, they instituted domestic policies which were quite harmful to the population. Wages stagnated or declined. Working hours went to the highest in the industrial world. Poverty rates were the highest in the industrial world. There was a major attack on labor rights and so on, and that was extremely unpopular. In fact, Reagan ended up in 1992, after the Bush administration was over, as the most unpopular living ex-president in the United States, with the exception of Nixon. Nixon slightly beat him out. And that was true right through the 80s. So when Reagan won what's called a landslide victory in 1984, meaning he got about 30% of the electorate, by a considerable majority, people who voted opposed his legislative program. They voted for other reasons, among them fear. There was constant pushing the panic button right through the 1980s. It started right away with Libyan hitmen wandering the streets of Washington in 1981, going to assassinate our cowboy leader who was hiding in the White House behind tanks, managed to save that. Before that was just managed to barely get out of that one, and the Russians were building an air base in Grenada, which they were going to use to bomb the United States while, you know, the U.S. Air Force stood helplessly by. But we managed barely in time to save ourselves from that one, and we were standing tall, as the cowboy leader told us. 6,000 U.S. Special Forces succeeded in overcoming the resistance of about a couple of dozen unarmed Cuban paramilitary workers, and they got 8,000 medals of honor for it, but we were safe. After that came Gaddafi was at it again. There was an attack on the administration from the right wing, especially on George Shultz, Secretary of State. He wasn't militant enough. And fortunately, they discovered a Libyan invasion of the Sudan across 600 miles of desert, again with the U.S. and Egyptian air forces unable to do anything about it. The plot was so well hidden that neither Egyptian nor Sudanese intelligence knew about it, and the few American reporters, very few, who went to investigate, of course, found that it was a total fraud. But it was enough for Shultz to get up on television and strike heroic poses, tell us how Gaddafi's back in his box because of our powerful cowboy, and so on. Then came the Nicaraguans, 2 days' marching time from Texas. And then it went on and on, one thing after another. A lot of it was domestic. Now, those of you here well remember, I'm sure, how George Bush the First managed to win the election, his presidential election, namely by playing a very vulgar race card, the Willie Horton card. So if it was race, crime, drugs, Nicaraguans, Libyans, one thing after another, and the population was kept enough in a panic so that they could stay in office and push through their reactionary agenda. Now they want to do it much more extensively. As you have maybe read, the Treasury Department and the Department of the Budget, the Bush administration economists have just released a study showing an anticipated $44 trillion deficit in the next couple of years, which will be a fiscal train wreck. The economists are commenting on it. It was kept out of the, it was supposed to go into the budget last February, but they kept it out because they didn't want people to know about it when they're trying to push through another tax cut for the rich. And almost everyone recognizes that this is on purpose. They want a fiscal train wreck. If you have a fiscal train wreck, you have to have what's called fiscal responsibility, meaning cut back spending, not cut back spending that goes into the pockets of rich people, so there'll be plenty of that, but cut back on social spending, eliminate Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, funding for the states so that they'll have huge deficits, eliminate public schools and so on, and just roll back any of the progressive legislation of the past century. It's a pretty awesome program. And it's got to be conscious. I mean, there's no way that they could be doing this without understanding it. And how are you going to get people to accept it? Well, exactly the way that Karl Rove described. Frighten them. Terrify. That's what happened last September, and that's what's going to happen for the next election. That they understand, and it's hard to miss it. Those are the three events: national security strategy, the propaganda about the Iraqi threat, and the election, which happened to be a midterm one, but the same thing's going to happen next time, just as it happened right through the 80s. I mean, we have to really be blind not to see that the script is being replayed in a much more extreme form. Well, the national security strategy is a doctrine. And if you announce a doctrine and you want people to take it seriously and make sure that they know you mean it, you have to implement it. So you have to have what's called a test case, or what the New York Times called a Petri dish, to make people understand you really mean this. Well, the test case for the doctrine has to meet several conditions. First of all, it has to be defenseless. I mean, nobody with any of their brains functioning would attack anybody who can shoot back. So you have to pick a defenseless country, and it has to be one that's important enough to conquer. So there's no use picking some country in Central Africa that nobody wants. Thirdly, you have to be able to present the target as an awesome power, either about to commit genocide or about to destroy us. Okay, Iraq qualified on all three counts. It's completely defenseless, and they knew it. It's very important. It's right in the heart of the major oil-producing regions of the world. It itself has the second largest reserves in the world, and controlling those resources has been a centerpiece of U.S. policy since the 1940s, Britain before it. And it's not hard to portray it as an ultimate evil. All you have to do is pick up the rhetoric that you hear from Tony Blair and Colin Powell and George Bush, which you've heard 1,000 times, about how this man is so evil that he even committed the ultimate crime. He used poison gas against his own people. Obviously, he can't be allowed to survive. And on and on, always missing from the impassioned orations is that he did it with our help, because we didn't, because the, in fact, help the people now in Washington, because they didn't care. So they therefore overrode congressional attempts to condemn the atrocities, went on supporting their friend Saddam Hussein, providing him with badly needed aid, agricultural means for developing weapons of mass destruction. It had nothing to do with the war with Iran. It went on without a change after the war with Iran was over. In fact, it went on up to the day of the invasion of Kuwait, when he committed a real crime, disobedience. You don't do that. But if you want to gas your own people, that's fine. And the same is true in England. There were parliamentary objections, but if you look at them, you find some names missing, like all of New Labour, Tony Blair, Jack Straw, Jeff Hoon, all missing. Didn't care, But now you can bring it up to prove how evil he is. Actually, we've just seen an interesting illustration of that in the last couple of weeks. I'm sure you saw they're digging up these horrendous mass graves throughout much of Iraq, where there are thousands of people buried from the Saddam Hussein's murderous repression of the insurrections of April 1991. And that's portrayed with proper horror, and again with the usual omission. Saddam Hussein was authorized to do that by George Bush, number one, Colin Powell, and the other, Dick Cheney, and the others who are now in charge, because who had complete command of the air and could have easily stopped in 1 minute, but they authorized Saddam Hussein to use advanced weapons and military helicopters and others to crush the rebellion. And what's more, if you look back, you'll even find the explanations. So Thomas Friedman, who was then the chief diplomatic correspondent of the New York Times, kind of voice for the State Department, essentially, in the New York Times, explained that makes us unhappy, but we have to do it. He said the best of all worlds would be an iron-fisted Iraqi military junta ruling Iraq the same way Saddam Hussein did, but without his name, because he's an embarrassment. And since we can't find the replacement, this is the second best. What cannot be allowed is for Iraq to be run by its own people. That would be unacceptable. And if there was rebellion, that's what would have happened. But that can't be tolerated. And in fact, the one consistent strain in U.S. policy over the years has been that. Other things vacillate, but the consistent part is they're not going to run it. Either we'll run it or some vassal will run it. Well, none of this is secret. Read it. read in the New York Times or anywhere else in 1991, but it's somehow miraculously missing. In any event, Iraq met all three conditions, given appropriate subservience and subordination on the part of the educated classes, which is not hard to get. It's defenseless. It's extremely important. And it can be portrayed as the ultimate evil, and indeed was. And certainly no one who supported Saddam Hussein and those actions should have impunity, which happens to include everyone in the White House right now. But that part isn't mentioned. The point of carrying out such an action is to establish, first of all, to gain control of Iraq, which is important in itself, but also to establish what's called a norm in international law. You have a doctrine, you apply it, that establishes a new norm. Of course, norms aren't established when weak countries carry out actions, only when the most powerful states carry out actions. So, for example, take, say, humanitarian intervention. There's supposed to have been a new norm of humanitarian intervention established in the 1990s. We could debate the cases, but that's the standard version. And some questions arise. Why was the alleged new norm of international intervention, humanitarian intervention, established in the 1990s? I mean, why not, for example, in the 1970s? In the 1970s, there did take place two military actions, which, since the Second World War, are by far the most significant in ending really terrible atrocities. The first was the Indian invasion of what's now Bangladesh in 1971, which put to an end horrendous atrocities, millions of people. The second was the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia in 1979, which put an end to Pol Pot's atrocities, drove the Khmer Rouge out of the country, just at the time when the atrocities were peaking. There's nothing in the 1990s that comes even close to this. We could argue about whether those two actions qualify as humanitarian intervention, but there is not the slightest doubt that they put to an end major atrocities vastly beyond anything that happened in the 90s. So why isn't that the decade of humanitarian intervention? Well, because countries like India and Vietnam can't establish norms. They don't rule the world. So therefore, that's not a norm. If the U.S. does something, no matter how shaky the argument, that establishes a norm. Furthermore, the United States was strongly opposed to both of those interventions. The Indian invasion was the U.S. Actually threatened war. The primary reason was that India was spoiling some photo ops for Henry Kissinger, who was planning a secret trip to China through Pakistan, and this kind of, you know, spoiled the opportunity, so he was furious, and the U.S. sent a nuclear-armed aircraft carrier into the Bay of Bengal and threatened sanctions and so on. In the case of Vietnam, it was even worse. Vietnam was bitterly denounced for getting rid of Pol Pot. The U.S. imposed very harsh sanctions on them. It supported a Chinese invasion to punish them for this crime, and the U.S. turned immediately to supporting Pol Pot directly, both militarily and diplomatically. So obviously that couldn't have established a new norm. When powerful states do it, it can be a new norm. And now we read eloquent descriptions in the international law literature about how the new norm of preventive war has been established by the U.S. Invasion of Iraq. And now that there's a norm, you know, you can go on to the next step, and we can, in fact, expect more of the same. Well, let's take a look at that doctrine that was announced last September. One important question to ask is how new it is. And it is in some ways new. There's a good reason why the world was startled and upset by it. but it's not quite as new as is often believed. There are precedents. When Colin Powell says it's not without precedent, he's quite accurate. So let's have a look at a couple of those. One important precedent at the opposite end of the political spectrum was in just 40 years earlier, in 1963, when Dean Acheson, respected elder statesman, senior advisor to the Kennedy administration, gave a lecture to the American Society of International Law, in which he explained to them that if the he said that no legal issue arises if the U.S. responds to a challenge to its power, position, and prestige. Okay? So if anyone poses a challenge to the power, position, and prestige of the United States, and the United States responds by violence or in any other way, it's not a legal issue. Notice that his wording goes well beyond the national security strategy. They at least talk about a threat. He didn't talk about a threat, just a challenge to position, power, and prestige. Acheson's remarks were particularly significant because of the timing. This was immediately after the Cuban Missile Crisis had simmered down. It was already known then that the missile crisis came very close to leading to a nuclear war. How close, we've just learned last October. It's pretty shocking, but it was pretty well understood then already. The Cuban Missile Crisis was the result of an international terrorist campaign carried out by the Kennedy administration against Cuba, which was building up until October. During the crisis, the terrorist actions continued. They were briefly called off, and then they were picked up again right after the crisis was over. It was a major factor in the lunatic reaction of putting nuclear-tipped missiles there. This was an international terrorist campaign aimed at regime change. Familiar words these days. Right after that, as the international terrorist campaign and illegal economic warfare were picking up, Acheson explained to the legal profession that there's no legal issue when the United States carries out these actions. Why, incidentally, was it carrying out these actions? Actually, we are lucky to live in a very free society, and we have access to government planning documents beyond any other country in the world, as far as I know. And we know exactly why they were doing it, because a ton of documentation has come out, secret documentation. The problem was U.S. planners, Kennedy Johnson planners, called Cuba's successful defiance of the United States. They were defying a policy that goes back 150 years. Nothing about the Russians. The policy of 150 years was that this region has to be subordinated to U.S. power. And they were challenging that, and that was successful defiance, and that's unacceptable. Even more unacceptable was the fact that there was a threat, quoting Arthur Schlesinger in an internal document, there was a threat of the spread of the Castro idea of taking matters into your own hands, which might appeal to other people in the region who are suffering from similar circumstances, and that's got to be cut off right away. So therefore, the terrorism and the economic warfare were legitimate, and if they came close to a terminal nuclear war, that's the way the cookie crumbles. We're then going to go on, and in fact do. Well, those are the circumstances of Acheson's statement. That's at the left liberal end of the spectrum. Let's go over to the other end of the spectrum, the right wing, the current incumbents. In 1985, the Nicaragua, which was being subjected to an international terrorist campaign carried out by the current incumbents in Washington, brought a case to the World Court in which they asked the court to order the United States to terminate the terrorism and pay reparations. The United States refused to accept World Court jurisdiction, and that it withdrew its earlier grant of jurisdiction. And it was explained by Judge Abram Sofer, who was the legal advisor of the State Department, he explained it publicly. He said that in the early days of the United Nations, we could count on other countries to go along with what we said, which is true, under, given the conditions of power they had to. And he said, but by now, many other countries in the world just don't agree with us, and therefore we will have to reserve to ourselves the right to determine what falls within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States, in this case, a terrorist war against Nicaragua. Well, that's the other end of the spectrum, another clear precedent for the national security strategy. However, these, and there are many other cases, but these two examples are different from what happened in September in two crucial respects. Acheson and Sofer were describing policy, and in fact they were describing it accurately. That's the way it works. But they weren't proclaiming an official policy. That's quite a difference. Furthermore, Acheson and Sofer were talking within the family, so I doubt if many people know about this. You know about it if you're inside a narrow circle of people who pay attention to such things, but the population is not allowed to know that these are the guidelines of policy. We're supposed to believe all sorts of things about benevolence and Wilsonian this and that and so on and so forth. It's only inside closed circles that you're supposed to know about this. On the other hand, the national security strategy of last September was announced loud and clear. They want everybody to know about it. They want everybody to know that we are a revisionist state which uses force to achieve its ends and will do it without limits. That was announced as clearly as possible. The Iraq War made it clear to anybody who didn't believe the words. And that is a very significant difference. There are other precursors, and they're worth looking at, too. So take, just to understand ourselves, which is presumably a good thing to do, the National Security Council, which is the top planning body, was established after the Second World War in 1947. Its first memorandum, NSC number one, called for military support for underground operations in Italy, along with national mobilization in the United States. I'm quoting it now. In the event the communists obtain domination of the Italian government by legal means. Okay, in other words, there was an election coming up, and it looked as if they'd win. The resistance, anti-fascist resistance, had plenty of prestige, and Italy had a strong labor movement. But if they won the election by legal means, the United States would declare a national mobilization and support paramilitary and other activities inside Italy to overthrow the government. Okay, that's pretty strong state declaration. Fortunately, they were able to win the election by withholding food and reinstating the fascist police and diverting Marshall Plan aid only to the right people and so on. So they didn't win the election by legal means, but if they had, that's what would have happened. We can go back even earlier. So right before the United States got into the Second World War, before Pearl Harbor, there were high-level meetings going on of the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations planning for the post-war world. I mean, they knew this big event, the Second World War. They didn't know if the U.S. would be involved, but plainly it was going to have effects. And they naturally carried out careful planning. And that plans are worth reading. They've been public for 60 years, but they're never read. And they're extremely important not because only because they were high level planning, but because those are the plans that were pretty much implemented after the war. This is the War Peace Studies Group of the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations. And before the U.S. got into the war in 1940-41, they held that in the post-war world, the United States must hold unquestioned power, and it must act to limit, to ensure limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by states that interfere with U.S. global designs. And they recognized further that the foremost requirement to secure these ends is the rapid fulfillment of a program of complete rearmament, which is a central component of an integrated policy to achieve military and economic supremacy for the United States and to bar any exercise of sovereignty that might threaten it. Well, you'll notice that that's the national security strategy, okay? But again, with the same two reservations. It was plans, but it wasn't an open announcement of an official policy. Plans were indeed implemented. And it's inside. It's for the family, you know, not for the general public to know about, even though it was public. Well, at that time, these ambitions were limited to what they called the non-German world. It was assumed at that time that Germany would end up holding some part of the world. And the non-German world would be organized as what they called a grand area, which would include the Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, and the Far East. After Russia beat back the Nazi armies at Stalingrad, it was clear that Germany was going to be defeated, and the plans were extended to cover as much of Eurasia as possible. Well, that's earlier precedent, differing in the important respect that I mentioned. I'm losing track of time. Well, let me just make a couple of comments about the implications of all of this. There are some problems in implementing the grand design. Three major problems, one in the oil-producing regions, one in Europe, and one in Asia. They're all kind of the same problem, but different. You know, they show up in different ways. So in the Middle East, the primary concern of the United States has been, and for obvious reasons, control of the world's major energy resources. And there's a disruptive factor there, namely the Israel-Palestine conflict. So one problem is to somehow dampen down that problem and regain the support of the oppressive and dictatorial Arab states, which is kind of shaky because of this. And this is understood. So, for example, Michael Ignatieff at Harvard, who's one of the supporters of the Iraq War, had a long article in the New York Times magazine early January supporting the war, in which he pointed out accurately that the chief danger in the Iraq gamble is to enforce a peace of Palestinians and Israel. Otherwise, the region will remain in constant ferment. It may blow up, and the U.S. will lose its control of the world's major energy supplies. Well, how do you deal with that? Front pages tell you that there's something called a roadmap, which is a map towards the president's vision of a Palestinian state. I'm sure you've noticed that there's a journalistic convention that when you mention George Bush, you have to mention in the same paragraph his vision or his dream or something like that. And there's usually a picture accompanying it of George Bush staring off into the distance at his vision with his eyes narrowed and so on. One interesting thing about these visions and dreams is that although we're supposed to worship them, no one has a clue what they are. You know, nothing is ever said about what the vision is, and that's important. The public relations people understand that. So if you want to find out something about the vision, you're going to have to look at events, you know, the events of history, documentary record, all forbidden territory that you're not allowed to go into. But that's the only way to find out what the vision is. Well, the fact is that the vision of a Palestinian state is not George Bush's. That was an international consensus back in the mid-70s. There was a very broad international consensus for a two-state settlement on the international borders. And without going into the details, it's been blocked unilaterally from the mid-70s until this minute by the United States. It simply wouldn't allow it. It's vetoed. Security Council resolutions voted alone and with Israel at the General Assembly, and in every possible way has blocked that vision. And nothing's changed in that respect. The same was true right through the Camp David 2000 negotiations. You read about the magnanimous and generous offers that Clinton and Barack were making and how the terrible Palestinians turned them down. But if you look carefully, there's an easy way to test that, very easy way to evaluate how generous and magnanimous the offers were. That's to look at a map. But you can't do that because the media and commentary journals were very careful not to publish a map. So if you search, you won't find a map unless you go out to dissident publications or scholarly sources, or the Israeli press, for example, where they published the maps. And there's a very good reason why the maps weren't published in the United States. As soon as you looked at the maps, you found that the Clinton-Barack proposal sort of made South Africa 40 years ago look pretty good when they were establishing the Bantustans. The Clinton-Barack proposals broke the West Bank into four almost separated cantons, little points of connection between them, one in the north, one in the central region, one in the south, three of them separated from a little area of East Jerusalem, which is the center of Palestinian commercial and cultural life, but is disconnected, and then, of course, it's all disconnected from Gaza. So kind of a Bantustan proposal. Meanwhile, Clinton and Barack were busily using your dollars, it's paid for by U.S. dollars, of course, to build substantial settlement programs, infrastructure, and so on, to establish the facts of the Bantustan proposal, which was to be implemented at Camp David. Well, what's happened since? Let's take Bush. Bush, there are actions that you can look at, not just visions. So a good place to look is the United Nations, which has meetings in the General Assembly every winter. Bush's first intervention at the United Nations was to veto a Security Council resolution calling for the dispatch of international monitors to reduce the level of violence in the territories. That is the way to do it. But they don't want to do that. They want to allow the violence to continue because they know perfectly well it's overwhelmingly U.S.-backed Israeli violence, and they want that to continue even if it does lead to violence against Israelis. So monitors were blocked. At the same time, this is December 2001, Switzerland, which is the repository of the Geneva Conventions and responsible for them, Switzerland called another meeting, they do it regularly, of the high contracting parties, that's almost every country in the world, to Geneva to deal once again with the applicability of the Geneva Conventions to the occupied territories. Well, in the past, the United States supported that. So for years, the United States voted with the majority, in fact, Security Council, everybody, on the applicability of the Geneva Conventions to the occupied territories. Under Clinton, the United States moved to abstention. Didn't vote against or for, so they continues to be reaffirmed. Bush switched policy and essentially undermined it. He boycotted the meetings in Geneva, and therefore, when the U.S. boycotts something or vetoes it, it's a double veto. For one thing, it's blocked, and for another thing, it doesn't get reported, and it doesn't enter history. So this wasn't reported and didn't enter history, and that's quite important because the Geneva meeting reaffirmed, this is the whole European Union and even England and everybody else, reaffirmed that just about everything that the United States and Israel are doing in the occupied territories is a breach of the Geneva Conventions. And many of them are grave breaches. That means serious war crimes under U.S. law. The Geneva Conventions are not a joke. They were instituted after the Second World War to formally criminalize the crimes of the Nazis, the relevant one, the Fourth Convention, crimes of the Nazis in occupied territories. So the U.S. doesn't want publicly to say they don't apply, but what it's doing is silencing them, and Bush took that a stage forward. By undermining the meeting. Well, that's December 2001. December 2002, he went beyond. There's an annual resolution at the General Assembly which reaffirms a Security Council resolution of 1968, passed unanimously, the United States as well, ordering Israel to terminate and withdraw from its actions in occupied East Jerusalem. It's meaningless because the United States never enforces it, but at least it's been voted year after year. This year, for the first time, the Bush administration shifted position on that and voted against that resolution. Well, if that's meant seriously, that ends any possibility of a political settlement. It means it's authorizing Israel's occupation of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem by now is a huge area, cutting out a big piece of the West Bank. It's nothing like Jerusalem used to be. So that virtually cuts the West Bank in two, if the U.S. meant it. And there's every reason to think that they do. Bush's next statement about the Middle East was in February of this year. It was called, you know, highly touted in the press as his most significant comment on the Middle East, repeated right away by Powell. Most of it was just the usual boilerplate, wouldn't be nice to have peace, and so on and so forth. But there was one significant statement in it. Namely, he said that U.S.-backed Israeli settlements could continue without limit until progress is made in the peace process, and he'll decide when progress is being made. That's, again, a significant shift in policy. Up until now, there have at least been gestures to say that the settlements are illegal or maybe unhelpful or something, but this was a straight authorization of them. If you look at the roadmap, I won't go through the details, but it essentially repeats that. It says nothing about borders. It says nothing. In fact, it says something vague about terminating what's called natural growth in the settlements, but Ariel Sharon, the official man of peace, as he was called by Bush, immediately told the Israeli Knesset that don't worry about it. You can build there for your children and your grandchildren. So my soulful relation with President Bush guarantees that, and that's correct. So what's happening is just a continuation and extension of the policies of undermining any hope for a peaceful political settlement there. That's if you look at the facts. Of course, if you keep to the vision, well, then you can believe what you like. One final comment, because it's getting too late, but this is a really important topic, so it should be mentioned. Another comment has to do with Europe and Asia, especially Northeast Asia. There's a long-standing problem in post-war international affairs, and that is whether Europe will be subordinated to the United States or will pursue its own path. Okay, Europe's rich place, big place, on the scale of the United States. Economies on a scale of the United States, educated and so on, it's conceivable that it might go off on its own path. And that's always been a problem. The United States was in favor of the integration of Europe for all kind of reasons, but it was wary that it might take off on its own. This was described very lucidly by Henry Kissinger when he was National Security Advisor and Secretary of State back in 1973. 1973 was called the Year of Europe, to celebrate the unification of Europe. And Kissinger gave what's called the Year of Europe address, in which he informed the Europeans that they have to understand that Europe has what he called regional responsibilities within the overall framework of order maintained by the United States. In other words, don't think about posing a challenge. You can carry out your, you can take care of, immigration in the Mediterranean or whatever your regional responsibilities are, but it's within the framework of order maintained by the United States. That continues. Europe means primarily France and Germany. That's the industrial, financial heartland of Europe. And a large part of the hysteria about France and Germany in the last couple of months, which is kind of interesting in itself, but a large part of the hysteria has to do with concern that Europe might strike out on an independent course, as it could. Okay, the same problems are arising in Asia. Northeast Asia, which includes Japan, South Korea, China, Eastern Siberia, is by now, and has been for some years, the most dynamic economic region in the world. Its gross domestic product is considerably larger than the United States. It's growing fast. It has about half the financial reserves of the world. It's a major source of foreign direct investment in and by now out. It's an integrated region, has plenty of resources. Eastern Siberia and China have resources. The industrial countries of the region need the resources. It's a very natural unit. And it's significant, except in military force. It's on a par with the United States and Europe. Well, that's a concern, because Northeast Asia also could move on its own towards independence. And there's a lot of fuss now about North Korea, and this is part of what's behind it. I mean, the regional countries, all of them, want to pursue some kind of negotiated diplomatic settlement with North Korea, somehow integrate it, a horrible place, but they don't want a war. That would be too awful. They want to move to integrating it into the region somehow. And that makes a lot of sense from every point of view. Pipelines from Siberia through into South Korea through North Korea, or expansion of the Trans-Siberian Railroad into South Korea, would be important moves towards integrating the region. And as one high-level U.S. planning document, really recent analysis really put it, pipelines through North Korea could enhance regional stability and provide cheap alternatives to oil imported from the Middle East. Well, one of the ways the U.S. controls Northeast Asia and Europe is by controlling its energy resources. If they move towards independent energy resources and other resources, that would be a spur towards separating into an independent area. And with the resistance to the national security strategy that Eikenberry quoted, this is exactly what's feared, that other parts of the world are going to break out of this system, create their own areas, which could lead to unpleasant conditions if the U.S. really does insist on barring any challenge by violence, as it has stated that it will. These are the things that I think are right in the offing.